Many of us have a very clear idea about how we would like to be cared for at the end of our lives, but sharing those ideas with our loved ones can be difficult to do. This hour, End of Life Choices. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we'll talk about planning for the end of life with a palliative care doctor and the director of Iowa City Hospice. We'll also talk about a new campaign called Honoring Your Wishes. Then, later in the hour, we'll get a preview of a new one-woman show by actress and playwright Megan Gogarty. The show is called Housebroken, and it explores all of the hilarity and heartbreak that goes into buying and selling a house. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with actress and playwright Megan Gogarty about her new one-woman show, Housebroken. But first, we're going to talk about planning for the end of life. A new campaign called Honoring Your Wishes is designed to help people start conversations about end-of-life care. And with me today is Jane Dorman of Iowa City Hospice. She's the director of Honoring Your Wishes. Hello, Jane.
Hello.
Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. David Clark is also here. He's a clinical associate professor of family medicine at the University of Iowa and a palliative care physician at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Clark, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Jane, what is the need that you're trying to address with this campaign?
Well, we're really trying to help ensure that people's healthcare preferences are honored. And what we have found is that it's very difficult to talk about what is important to people, what their wishes are, and people don't like to think about end of life and what that might mean. So it can be hard. So we really want to create a culture change to open that conversation.
Where is the need? I mean, do people have opinions about and knowledge about what they would like for their own end of care life, or is that where the knowledge gap is?
Well, I think that there are lots of gaps. In terms of individuals, I think there's a lot more that we can do. Nationally, about 25 to 35% of people have advanced directives, advanced healthcare directives. But if they have them, they may not know where they are. They may not have told anyone about them. They may be locked in a bank, and they may not be they may not do what they're supposed to do at the right time.
All right. So some people may have strong feelings about what they want at the end of their lives, but they may not have told anyone. And I think, do also people tend to assume that their family members just kind of know intrinsically? You would know what I want. You've known me forever. Is that another problem?
Absolutely. We get that a lot. But the reality is we don't know. And what we're trying to do is help ensure that people's wishes are honored and that family and friends say, you know, I know what mom or dad want, and if I ever have to be in that role to make a decision for them, I will know what to do. I want to do the right thing.
So now a lot of people probably feel like their family physician is going to take the lead in this conversation, but that's another place where we have a real communication problem, Dr. Clark. What's wrong with assuming that the physician will lead this conversation and lead you where you need to go?
Well, I think across all specialties and disciplines, there are physicians who are very good at having conversations with patients. But if you look at the healthcare system nationally, there is really a problem of what I call conversation avoidance. That is conversations that are being avoided in family situations and between loved ones, but also between patients and their physicians. And there are many physicians who have a very difficult time having these conversations. Physicians are wired to do fixing. And they show their care and their commitment to their patients by ordering tests and doing interventions. Some disciplines more than others. Some of the high-tech specialties and those specialties that involve a lot of very complicated things, it's very technology-oriented. But physicians will often continue to do tests and interventions when there are no great fixes left. And there is a time to step back and to show the care and commitment to the patient and their families by having compassionate conversations with them and exploring what's most important to them in this situation that they're in, and doing truth-telling to the patient and to the family. And I'm sure you're sitting here thinking, well, that's what doctors do. They'll do that. No, they often don't.
Well, there was there's a documentary that you're going to be showing coming up soon on National Healthcare Decisions Day, which is April 16th, and it's called Consider the Conversation 2. So it's a second documentary in a series. And I was watching that yesterday, and I was really struck by one of the doctors who was telling a story about a patient that he had who had dealt with cancer over a long period of time, and he'd gone into remission, and then he dealt with it again. And the patient had asked him, you know, please tell me when it's time. That I need to have my last moments. And the doctor told him, and the patient died that night. And the doctor felt a tremendous amount of guilt because he felt like he communicated to this patient, I'm giving up all hope, you should give up all hope, and then the patient died. So I can imagine that from a doctor's perspective, the idea of telling a patient that you don't have much time left must be just a tremendous burden.
Mm-hmm. It's a skill that has to be thought about and learned over time to communicate effectively. I think it's very interesting in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, just in 2012, there was a study that reported that 60% of medical oncologists prefer not to discuss code status, that's the resuscitation status, or advanced medical directives, or even hospice, until there are no more treatments to give. Now, that means that there are others that do. But and I'm not here to try to pick on oncologists, because I think they really do grieve over their patients, and they get very involved and very attached to them, and they are committed, and they care. But it's, again, it's, I'll show my care by doing more. And there are times when what you really need to do is to step back and say, we really need to have conversations about you and the totality of who you are as a person. And that's much more difficult for many physicians to do.
I introduced you as a palliative care doctor, and we've talked about palliative care on this program in the past. But palliative care is a different kind of medicine because you're not working toward a cure. You're managing a disease. You're mm-hmm. managing pain. Mm-hmm. And I know that palliative care is becoming much more common and much more available, which is a bit of a culture shift. But still, even to refer someone to a palliative care doctor must be a difficult step for many, many physicians to take.
I think it's evolving. And I think that more and more, as my other colleagues learn more about what we do, and that we're really probably more than anything trying to enhance communication and trying to know what's most important to the patient, that's becoming more valued. And so, yeah, a culture is changing.
Do patients need to, at some point, ask, I would like to see a palliative care doctor?
Well, I think in the broader sense, and maybe Jane can address this a little bit more, but I think that patients and families do need to be more proactive in seeking out and talking about the things that are important to them. Because if you make the assumption that at some point in time, my doctor will let me know when it's time to have these important conversations, that may not happen. Because the doctor is probably assuming that the family will make that same choice. That's what we call the surplus of trust, that each is assuming that the other will
right.
have the conversation.
Well, and we were just talking about how doctors don't want to communicate to their patients that they're giving up hope. Well, families don't want to communicate to someone that they're giving up hope either. I mean, hope is a very important part of treatment and part of life and medicine. So, I mean, Jane, when do you recommend that people have these conversations? Because I know that can be a tough thing to bring up with your mother or your grandmother.
Absolutely. And Charity, in part of us wanting to create a culture change, we recommend that these conversations start early and think of advanced care planning as a dynamic process throughout life. So, for example, for me personally, when did I start having these conversations in my home? Actually, with my daughter is one example, when she went to get her driver's permit. They asked about organ donation. So that's just a very small example of beginning conversations of like, oh, well, what would you like? Well, what does that mean? Well, let's talk about that. And then for people who are 18 and over who have decision-making capacity, we recommend that everyone has advanced care planning conversations and completes a healthcare directive, because we never know when we might have a sudden illness or injury and may not be able to communicate. Who do we want to communicate on our behalf? Who do we want to be our advocate, our voice? And those conversations can start earlier, and then they evolve throughout life as our values, beliefs, as our health conditions change, et cetera. They change and are more in depth.
So if we have those conversations earlier, it takes away some of the emotional baggage that goes along with the conversation. What are some of the resources that people have that can guide them in having these conversations and drawing up paperwork?
They can go to www.honoringyourwishes.org. We've created a person-centered healthcare directive that is based on the Respecting Choices model out of La Crosse, Wisconsin. And it allows people to thoughtfully reflect on their values and beliefs and what that means in terms of their healthcare preferences. And then they also select a healthcare agent or medical power of attorney to who they would want to speak on their behalf if there were ever a need.
And give me an idea of some of the decisions that people need to make. Now, of course, organ donor is one of them. and that's something that a lot of us think about when we get our driver's license. But what are some of the other very important decisions that you need to think about and educate yourself about?
Well, one example is if you were to have a severe brain injury and were highly unlikely to ever recover the ability to know who you are, where you are, who you are with, what would your goals of care be? Would they change from full treatment and life-prolonging treatment to maybe withdrawing that or withholding that?
Okay. And also, I mean, you talked about do not resuscitate. Mm-hmm. And I realize that that's something that a lot of people need to talk about at the end of life. And actually, I think we should take a short break and get back and talk about do not resuscitate, because I think that that's a phrase that is loaded for a lot of people. And I think a lot of people don't really fully understand what it means. So we'll talk about that more in a moment. We're talking about end-of-life decisions today, advanced care planning and healthcare directives. With me is Jane Dorman of Iowa City Hospice. She's the director of the campaign Honoring Your Wishes. Dr. David Clark is also here. He's a palliative care physician at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. And also coming up on April 16th, that's National Healthcare Decisions Day, there'll be a showing of the documentary Consider the Conversation, Two Stories About Cure, Relief, and Comfort at the Senior Center in Iowa City at 6 p.m. Again, that's coming up on April 16th. Later this hour, I'll talk with actress and playwright Megan Gogarty. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about end-of-life decisions, end-of-life care, advanced care planning, and healthcare directives. And you can join our conversation as well with your questions or with your experiences. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Jane Dorman of Iowa City Hospice. She's the director of the Honoring Your Wishes campaign. Dr. David Clark is a clinical associate professor of family medicine at the University of Iowa. He's also a palliative care physician at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. And when we think about end-of-life care, there are long-term decisions that we can make and we can talk to our family members about, but also there are things that come up quite suddenly for a lot of people, decisions that have to be made in the moment. And of course, we can't see the future. So, Dr. Clark, what do we need to think about when it comes to those decisions?
Well, if the patient is able to speak for themselves, we always go back to the patient. So the patient's the boss. We're there for the patient. We're there to serve the patient. When it comes to questions such as resuscitation, it's very important to have an informed discussion. People have their ideas of what resuscitation is. It's interesting when I have these conversations to say, do you understand what it is? Oh, yeah, yeah, I know what it is. But they get that idea primarily from the media. And when they watch their favorite shows on television, they get the idea that this resuscitation thing works really quite a lot. In fact, there was a study that was done once in which certain key programs were reviewed by researchers, and they found that 60 to 70% of the time the shows on the media that they reviewed show successful outcomes. And of course, all of the wonderful magical things that happen along with it. But in real life, the outcomes are much lower. So in having a conversation about resuscitation, it ultimately gets back to the person's goals, where they are, what their expectations are, what they're hoping to achieve by what they do. Is this resuscitation going to be a bridge across a crisis that will allow them to get to some future goal, or will it be a trap of suffering for them? And so we're always trying to sort out what are the bridges and what are the traps for each patient, and that will vary from patient to patient. But a patient should know what they're signing up for when they sign up for a resuscitation, and they should understand what a do not resuscitation also means.
But of course, if I, how do I know when I sign up whether this would be a bridge or whether this would be a trap? I mean, how do I make that decision?
You are asking an excellent question as to why you need to have a healthcare agent who can speak for you if you cannot speak for yourself. You know, in the moment or in the critical times, if you're not able to speak for yourself, then you want someone who is designated legally to be your actual voice in all matters of in all decision making. Documents are static. They are, if you put down, this is what I do, this is what I don't want, for instance, in a living will, you can maybe have some very precise things there, but those are there to guide the people who will speak for you, because if you can speak for yourself, you don't need a document. So a static document with preferences is there for the person who will speak for the patient. But you want to have that person chosen wisely.
Right. Well, I was just going to ask you that because, you know, in my case, I would just very naturally choose my husband. But if I were to be in a traumatic car accident, for example, it's very likely that I will be in that accident with my husband. Mm-hmm. So how do you choose who has the power of attorney?
Well, you choose carefully, and we recommend that you choose one person and then an alternate as well. So if they're not willing to or not willing or able to serve in that role, who would you like to be as the backup person?
And the documents can be, you can add as many agents in order as you want, but it will go to the person who's listed as the primary. And then if they're not able or if they give that decision-making over to the next person, they can. But that person should know you well enough so that hopefully you've had the conversations. You've sat down, you've gone over this in some manner, and you've left some things that give direction. Because when the person's in that situation, you do not want them to decide out of their own grief, and or you don't want them to decide, well, I know what they would want, but this is what I think is the right thing. You don't want them to do that. You want them to say, I'm speaking for this person and to my best understanding of this person as I know them in their totality. And from all that we've discussed, this is what I believe they want.
We have an email from Ben in Washington. He said that he and his wife are in their 30s, but recently met with a funeral director to get our final wishes down on paper just in case. It was a little awkward at first, but once we got talking, it felt great to get it taken care of. We also were happy that getting together a living will is quite easy and painless. Coincidentally, we finished up all that work on Valentine's Day. Yeah. So what could be more romantic than that?
Could I just comment?
Yeah.
They did a very loving thing for each other. And I would just add that living will, again, is a static document. And I'm sure part of that paperwork that was done was that they also designated power of attorney for healthcare, because that is the single most important document. If there's one document you just must have done, it's that one.
Julia is on the line from Des Moines at 866-780-9100. Hi, Julia.
Hi.
Hi, what's your story?
My story would be perhaps a sad story in that my father had Parkinson's disease, and we had, through lawyers, and drawn up all end-of-life documents and things. And, of course, with Parkinson's, it's a long and agonizing process. And he had do not resuscitate, which everyone within the family was clear about. And 3 days before his death, he called in the people at the hospital and rescinded those orders. His Parkinson's doctor talked to him and also called in other professionals in the hospital. And it was very troubling. He was an extremely faithful and religious man, and one would have thought that he would have been looking toward the hereafter. But in the end, he was on life support. And to my mother's strength, she had the courage to pull the plug. And it was an agonizing decision and still haunts me many years now after the fact to have to go through such a trauma, knowing that we did something he didn't want to have done.
Oh, Julia, I'm so sorry for your loss and what a difficult experience. And it sounds like Julia's family did everything right. They talked to each other, they communicated with each other, but of course you don't know what you're going to feel when it comes right down to that point. Jane, are there any words you can offer for Julia?
Well, I think that we can only do what we can do, absolutely. And I'm sorry that this was such a difficult process. But the healthcare professionals have to go with the voice of the person, as we mentioned. And so it's that continual process of discussion that perhaps, you know, sometimes people change their minds and that's the reality. But it's very hard.
Yeah, and I'm sure in that situation that a lot of thought went into the decisions. Again, exploring with the patient the reasons for why their opinions change is important to investigate and to make sure the patient is decisional. But it's not a perfect world, and despite our best efforts, Jane, I agree with you, there are times that just what happens is what happens. We can only talk about how we can make the best possible pathway. One of the documents that maybe Jane might want to talk about is the iPost, which is a new document that's being used in Iowa that might be of interest.
Yes. iPost stands for Iowa Physician Orders for Scope of Treatment, and it turns people's healthcare preferences into a medical order. And it's intended for people who are closer to the end of life, so frail and elderly people, people with terminal illnesses, and people with chronic critical medical conditions, who interface a lot with the medical system, for children and adults. So it's a wonderful way to continue the conversation. You know, we promote that everyone have a healthcare directive first, but then talk with their healthcare provider if they think that this is something that they may want and that's appropriate for them, to have more in-depth discussions related to if they would want CPR to be attempted if their heart and breathing stops, or if they would prefer a natural death. Also, in terms of medical interventions, what type of care they would or would not want, such as would they like to go to ICU or would they prefer to avoid that? Would they prefer to be in their home or home-like residence and receive comfort care as much as possible? And only if those symptoms couldn't be managed would they want to go to the hospital? So I think these are some of the bigger questions that are, for example, where would a person like to pass away? Would they like to be at home? Would they like to be at home surrounded by friends and family? If so, what kind of supports can we put in place, such as hospice, to help ensure that they have the highest quality of life possible at that time?
Yeah, and just to add to the IPOST, this is a document that is designed to travel with patients across different settings. It's really there to fill the gaps in when you're out of a hospital environment. When you're in a hospital, it's a highly controlled environment, and every aspect of the care and all of these questions are clarified. But once a patient leaves the hospital, there hasn't previously been a good document that tells the emergency medical system what to do for that person if they're at home or if they're in a care center or if they're in their car traveling from one place to another. You can imagine something happens to your loved one. They're sitting there in the car. You pull over. You call 911. That's what most people do on their cell phones. And if you have this document, which is designed to travel with the chronically ill patient, because it is really designed for a person who's estimated to be in their last year of life, it's a document that it directs the emergency medical system what to do and what their desires are. And then also when they do, if they do end up at a healthcare facility, it directs other people what it is that what the patient desires. It's actually a physician's order. And like any other physician's order, it can always be changed. But it's there as a way of helping EMS, the emergency medical system.
We're talking about end-of-life care and advanced care planning today. With me, Dr. David Clark, a palliative care physician at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and Jane Dorman of Iowa City Hospice. And there was an article out a few years ago now. It was an in-depth article about how doctors choose to die. And it was a fascinating article because it showed that most doctors, when they reach the end of their lives, they don't choose a lot of the invasive kinds of procedures that are available. And that, you know, the article raises a lot of questions. Of course, one of them is, so the most informed people are choosing the fewer interventions. What do I need to know about those interventions? I mean, how can the public really understand what is going on?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it's a personal decision, but physicians have access to information, but also their accumulated observations of what they see around them, of what does work and doesn't work, and what suffering looks like, and what medical interventions truly are bridges to goals and what become traps of suffering. And what might be a bridge for you in January might be a trap of suffering in February. And so these things change, but physicians have, they're finely tuned to be able to recognize that, and they are able to separate out those things for themselves much more easily. I did a Google search this morning, how physicians die. It is very fascinating, the articles that do pop up. And it's a reflection of understanding.
So we've talked earlier about how physicians have a hard time talking to family members, talking to patients in the stark reality of the end of life. If someone in the family is able to ask a doctor these pointed questions, do you believe that would open the communication and the doctors would be able to answer and guide them?
Physicians want to be able to help. They want to be able to fix. They want to be able to please. I think that if a patient says, "Doc, I'm a straight shooter and I want you to give it to me straight. I just don't want any sugarcoating. I have these questions." I think the vast majority of doctors are now given permission to speak in a way that they have not previously felt comfortable to speak because they have difficulty about creating emotional distress for patients. Once they understand, I want some straight talk, doctors are really good about having this little switch change in their mind and they can start to speak very clearly.
We have an interesting email. This is from Cindy in Ames. She says, "I was under the very naive impression that something called hospice had solved the problem of dying and that if it were needed, an overdose of pain medication could be given to the dying person." And she, of course, learned that that was not true. But she says she feels that Iowans need to be aware that there are limits to what medicine can do, period. And, of course, aid in dying is not legal in the state of Iowa. It's not legal in very many places in the United States. But Do you find that, people do have some very naive assumptions about how much pain can be controlled at the end of life?
Each patient's situation is its own clinical problem and circumstance. And people suffer a variety of ways. They suffer physically, emotionally, relationally, spiritually, and then in very practical terms. And we call that total pain, the total package of all-encompassing suffering. And so at end of life, there's often suffering that you cannot just take care of with a little more medicine. On the other hand, I think there, in the vast majority of cases that I have managed over the years, and Jane might be able to comment on this as well, but in the vast majority of cases, I think that we have had symptom management that has been acceptable to those that are watching, such that if they would say, if that was me, I think I would accept that.
Well, we are out of time, but thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking us.
Dr. David Clark, a palliative care physician at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and Jane Dorman of Iowa City Hospice. She's the director of Honoring Your Wishes. And you can find out more information if you're looking for this kind of paperwork or the guidance. You can search for Honoring Your Wishes, and there are lots of links to information that can really help you. Also, coming up on April 16th, it's National Healthcare Decisions Day, and there'll be a showing of the documentary Consider the Conversation 2, Stories about Cure, Relief, and Comfort at the Senior Center in Iowa City at 6 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.